What's up, guys? Welcome back to West Coast Bias Season 4, Episode 4. We're recording on the heels of probably the biggest trade in the last few years, I would say. Anthony Davis traded to the Lakers for Brandon Ingram, Lonzo Ball, Josh Hart, fourth pick, and essentially 6 to 7 years of pick ownage from the Pelicans over the Lakers, to be specific. A 2021 pick, if in the top eight, followed by a right to swap in 2023 and 2024, and an unprotected in 2025, is that right? Something like that.
So it's 2019 number four.
Yeah.
2020 nothing. 2020 just they're not taking the pick. 2021 is when it's the top eight reverse protection. So it's only there if it's in the top eight and not going to get it in 2022.
That's right.
Which I'm guessing the Lakers did that because 2022 is supposed to be the double draft. And 2022, if not in top eight, that's when we're talking about them potentially drafting LeBron's son, which is goodness gracious if that happens. That's going to be the story of the decade. 2023 is a straight unprotected. No, 2023 is just a straight swap. 2024 is a straight unprotected.
With deferred to 25, yeah.
The craziest shit I have ever seen on a pick protected in my life.
Yeah, I mean, they were... Man, considering it seems like... Well, we'll go into it more, but considering it seems like there weren't actually that many other offers on the table, that's a lot. Especially considering the guys going into free agency in a year. But let's start with that. Was... For the Lakers, was this worth it? One thing that we're seeing is... I mean, it obviously makes the Kawhi trade now, you know, look like a steal if the championship hadn't already done that. But with LeBron James being 35, that's the first thing that jumps out at me. He's 35. He hasn't played in a year. He is, I would say, a maximum of two more years at, like, LeBron James-like form. Is this only worth it, I guess? Obviously, it's only worth it if they win a title in the next 2 years. Do you think they're going to win a title this year or next year? That's the question, I guess.
So there's two things that really make this trade work a lot better than I thought when I had originally been thinking about it. First, I didn't find out until maybe 2 days ago, about 6 hours before the trade actually went through, that James has a out clause in the last year of his four-year contract. It's a 3+1, not a straight four, as initially reported, which means he really will only be with the Lakers for two more years with the way things are currently progressing. That stood out to me because they're not even guaranteed the end of his prime like I thought they were. So they need to win in the next two calendar years. Obviously, Anthony Davis expected to join them in free agency next year. If they were a team that had a reason to be patient, they would just bide their time, hope that he didn't extend with whatever team traded for him, and maybe put out something with just these rookies, and if they don't get Davis next year, then they extend Ingram instead. But that's not really an option if we know this team did not work last year. It explicitly did not work. It was, for all this much ballyhoo, 2 week stretch in December. The Sacramento Kings had a 2 week stretch in January like that. The Atlanta Hawks had a 2 week stretch in March like that. You can't build a team around a 2 week stretch. There was a stretch, what was it, a year and a half ago, I believe, when the Atlanta Hawks were the best team in the league for a full calendar month, and they still were the 9 seed in the East that year. These aren't the ways you can make decisions. What we saw for the most part of that team, it was bad. They could not bring that team back.
So the worry with me for this trade is I think a lot of people right now are probably rightly concerned that they have approximately, you know, 4 to 5 players on their roster.
But two of them are Isaac Bonga and I believe the guy from Michigan.
And they also have some major cap holds on that horrible suicide squad with Beasley and all them. So it's not, they're not necessarily able to go out and, other than maybe the one free agent that which we'll talk about in a second, they're not exactly able to go out and get all, you know, the filler veterans, at least at this point. It could be like a vet minimum at the, you know, in February, but at this point they're not necessarily able to just fill out the roster with a bunch of LeBron favorites due to their cap situation. There will be
a situation where if they get a superstar in free agency on top of this, which it's arguable to find anybody they get as a superstar, but if they got a third star on a max contract, they would have to fill 10 full roster positions with minimum contracts and rookie deals.
Right, and there will be the veterans, you know, the Trevor Ariza's of the world, that will be interested in that kind of stuff, and those, they probably will be able to fill out a roster at some point next season with those players. But I think the important thing to note here is what people said about Toronto this year, for instance, is that they were able to give Kawhi a lot of rest and load management, yada yada yada, which made him more ready for the playoffs. But they were the deepest team in the league, I think, by far. Maybe the Nuggets, but the Lakers are not going to have that luxury. And LeBron has shown a proclivity in the last 3 or 4 years of taking plays off, taking entire quarters off, taking entire games off, and just pure numbers wise, they're not going to be able to get away with that this year, especially at the end of the year when maybe they're fighting for positioning.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about a team that at the end of the year last year when they needed do or die must win situations. The simple truth is that for most of those games, James didn't play the defense at the level he does in the playoffs, let alone at the level he did back in 2012, 2013 when he was a defensive player of the year type player.
Yeah, I mean, he's 35 years old. Now. Yeah. I think the counter argument to this, right, is everything that we've seen with Kawhi this year, is that there are some players that you forget how good they are, and we think that'll happen with Kawhi, and I think that might happen with Anthony Davis. And if you have two of the best players in the league, that automatically gives you a shot. I think what makes this different is that whereas Kawhi is 27 and has a fully constructed roster with potential and current all-stars around him, LeBron is 35 and really time-constricted on the year. Not that the Raptors weren't, obviously, because there's always the threat that Kawhi was going to leave. But in this case, they really have the pressure on them to win this year, and they don't really have another choice, because if they don't, it's Rich Paul has now said, right, that Anthony Davis is going to be a free agent next year, whether he's on the Lakers or not. Now, obviously, if they win a title, that's fine, but if we have a repeat of what we saw last year, there's a real chance that LeBron wants out and Anthony Davis wants out, and they don't have any draft picks for 7 years.
What it reminds me of is when the Cleveland Cavaliers had James have a luxury of time and had Kyrie and just had brought in Andrew Wiggins, and they still made the choice, knowing full well that Kevin Love was expected to sign with them next summer, to trade for Love the year before. That was much more private. They did a much better job, quite frankly, on the agent's behalf of hiding the fact that this was happening. But that was later we discovered that's what was happening. And Kevin Love still almost left the Cavs after being traded there. I mean, we talk about Paul George stayed at OKC because OKC was a good place for him to actually be, and he learned the Lakers wouldn't be. But what if Anthony Davis learns he doesn't like playing with LeBron, he doesn't like being second fiddle, he doesn't like being in that market, and even if he plays well and he wins a title, maybe he does what we're talking about Kawhi potentially doing and says, I want what's best for me, and this isn't what's best for me.
Right, well, so the Lakers, especially with the whole Durant-Thompson situation, which we'll get to in a second, where do you rank them currently, before we get to the Pelicans, because they're probably what the more interesting situation right now. There's not really a whole much to talk about with the Lakers besides they kind of have to win, et cetera, et cetera. Are they now favorites in the West, assuming they're able to assemble some sort of roster around these two? Or at least near the top?
As constructed right now, with the assumption that we're going to get another summer of Rob Pelinka trying to build a roster and trying to attract someone else, I don't think they're favorites in the West. I don't even think they're top six in the West. I think in 2 weeks that's going to change, but it's not going to be, because the only way that it's going to change is if a true game-changing player, and that's one exact person, and we both know who it is, decides for some reason that he wants to be the number three on the team after winning a championship. And if that doesn't happen, then I don't think they're even close to the favorites in the West. But they're obviously, they're a playoff team this year, as they were not last year. Right. But, of course, all of that just depends on if Pelinka can find 10 people who could play competent minutes next to James, Davis, and Kuzma.
Well, and one of the other things that we haven't talked about is that if this team, they're still run by the same people, right? We still have Magic's out, but Pelinka's still running this team. You have the various reason, Kurt Rambis and
his wife still running this team.
Right, and Kurt Rambis and Jeannie Buss. The clown car is pretty much intact with the exception of Magic.
With the exception of the one person on this roster that's actually a Hall of Famer at the sport.
Right, and other than this trade with Davis, which can be, you can argue that it wasn't a very good trade, especially if we'll look back in 2 years and be like, oh, did they win this trade? Did they not win this trade? Blah, blah, blah. But it's still run by the same organization, right? It still has a 35-year-old LeBron James who cleared out yet again for everyone he wanted. It's a team coached by Frank Vogel, who, if they struggle, is probably going to be fired halfway through the year. And then Jason Kidd's going to be there, and that probably will not go super well. Though, as far as free agents go, though, out of, let's say, Kemba, who seems like he really is not going to want to leave Charlotte for whatever reason. Who knows what.
The man said he'd take less.
Yeah.
Well, so sad.
We're hoping he doesn't have a wish I didn't say that moment in a few weeks, but Jimmy
Kemba
Butler.
Walker, just as an aside, Kemba Walker is the first player in the entire league that I've wanted to leave his original team.
I know. Yeah, it's very sad.
In the history of basketball.
But Jimmy Butler, Kemba Walker, and I guess throw someone like Tobias Harris or Kyrie onto that list. It's not really a very long list because I don't see any situation where Kawhi decides he wants to go to the Lakers. He may very well leave Toronto, but if he does, it's hard for me to see him going to the Lakers.
The Knicks would make more sense to me than the Lakers because the Knicks, he could have that big star in a big city feel with no pressure whatsoever, and he would still be the unquestioned biggest person in the city. I think the chances of him going to the Lakers got even lower after this trade. If he didn't want to play there with LeBron, why would he want to be the third fiddle on that team? But the thing is also just nobody knows what Kawhi Leonard's thinking. The fact that we think he might even leave at all is proof that he could do anything,
yes.
Which is why I think there's a slight outside chance that we have to consider that maybe he wants to go to the Lakers.
I think there's certainly a chance.
I think if we're talking about guys who might really consider it, go like to the point where they take meetings, I think that's three people. I think that's not Kemba Walker, which is apparently their number one target. I think it's Kawhi, not Kawhi, sorry, Kyrie. I think it's
bizarre on its own.
Yeah, very strange if that happens. Terrible choice for Kyrie, frankly. I think it's Klay Thompson, and I think the most likely fit that actually works for both parties is Jimmy Butler.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I see no world in which Klay Thompson leaves Golden State, but I suppose it's possible. I think Jimmy Butler is really the only option at this point, and there's a real chance he re-signs with Philly.
Yeah.
A real shot. In which case, you know, you're left with the Tobias Harris's. And
Nikola Vucevic.
Nikola Vucevic and D'Angelo Russell's of the world.
This is a strange class because it's about 15 deep with max contract guys, but only 8 of those are guys where max contracts are better than their value.
Well, and it was much deeper, you know, before 2 of the best 7
right.
got season-ending
injuries.
And
not just 2 of the best 7 in the class, 2 of the best 12 or so in basketball.
Right. So, yeah, for the Lakers, it's really in, they're gambling on their exceptionalism, right? It's not really – which hasn't really worked for them since 2010.
Right.
So
it hasn't worked – it hasn't really worked for them.
It didn't really work for them.
Last time they did this trade.
Right. You know, it could be a Dwight. One thing that we didn't ever compare it to was the Dwight Howard deal, which Anthony Davis is obviously much better than Dwight Howard. But if he decides he has a horrible year and they're just as dysfunctional as they ever were, which is, you know, a very high chance of happening, even if they do, you know, sneak into the top 4 in the West or something like that, there's a real chance he's like, you know what, I'm going to go to the Clippers or Boston or somewhere like that.
Well, here's the real problem, and I don't think this is something people want to consider because it's just a dark thought, but what if Anthony Davis isn't better than Dwight Howard? Dwight Howard, at this point in his career, had been to the NBA Finals. At this point, Anthony Davis has won one series in his entire life. He's been in 3. 2 of them were losses to the Warriors. Only 1 win in those 9 games versus the Warriors. To be fair, all-time great game with a hilarious photo where Drew Brees looks like he did a Renaissance painting, but still, 1 win over 9 games. You talk about Dwight Howard, I mean, obviously that team, the Charlotte that he had, not Charlotte, Orlando, was built around him in a much more effective way than any Pelicans team Davis was ever on. But he still went to the NBA Finals with a bad team.
Right.
And what if Dwight Howard had a higher ceiling and was better than Anthony Davis at this point in his career? Obviously, LeBron at 35 is better than Kobe at 35, but I don't necessarily think that trade bodes well for this trade, because that's the closest thing we've seen to this decade.
It's certainly an analog.
Last time anything like this was the Celtics with Kevin Garnett, and that was a much, much better team.
Well, and even more so from that, even if he is as good, and, you know, he probably is, he's never had to deal with anything like what he's going to have to deal with in LA. He's never had to play with anyone like LeBron, or had to, depending on how you want to look at that. He's never had to dealt with the shit show that's the Lakers right now. He's never had these kind of expectations. He's always been kind of the victim of the situation, whereas all of a sudden, if he doesn't play well, it's going to turn the other way real quick. So, you know, I've trying to give my expectations for this team a little boost because I kind of understated the Kawhi effect. And I think that having a player that's, you know, a top 5 player in the league, especially at that kind of position, is something that's incredibly valuable. And also, while simultaneously not forgetting how good LeBron James is. But the fact of the matter is, he's 35. Bron is 35 and Anthony Davis has never played in a real situation before. And there's a lot of good teams in the West, which is the next thing I want to talk about. How does this not only this trade, but also the loss of Thompson and Durant for the Warriors next year affect teams like the Rockets, the Blazers, the Nuggets, the Clippers, even the Kings or the Spurs?
This is the fun part. It's a damn shame that it had to happen this way. I really hoped it was going to happen exactly like this, but with Thompson, Durant, and Cousins all leaving in free agency, it would have been much more fun. But right now we're talking about a situation where the Warriors just went from 20 games better than every team in the West to about 5 games below every team in the West. And we're talking about a situation where we have to see Steph Curry do something he hasn't done in his entire career. He has never been in a situation where he was the only good player because he and Thompson developed so simultaneously. He has never been in a situation where he's needed to make the playoffs and there's been real pressure on him to do it. And now there's going to be 13 teams in the West doing that. And that's going to be very interesting and very fun. And unless the Nuggets stay at the production they were at last year and are a believable threat in the playoffs, I genuinely believe we're talking about a situation where we have 13 contenders to win the Western Conference, not just in the regular season, but in the playoffs.
So let's go team by team with the main ones. So the one I'm most interested about is the Rockets, because indications was, you know, they're ready to trade Chris Paul. They're going to try to do it a different way. Surely, if you're Daryl Morey and you're in, Capella's clearly been up for offer. I never really understand the idea that you can't play Clint Capella in a playoff series. I don't think he was necessarily the one that was the
reason. Well, the problem is you can't play Clint Capella against Dwight Howard.
Right.
Against Draymond
Green. Right.
And that's no longer a risk because the Warriors no longer have the talent to run a small ball line.
Right. So if you're the Rockets and you run it back, you're the best team and the most experienced team in the West, right?
Right. And you're built perfectly to beat the only two teams that are real threats in the East to you with what's happening to the Celtics and potentially the Sixers. I think they're an insanely good fit against the Raptors, and I think they're a decent fit against the Bucks. Not necessarily the championship favorite, but you go from a team that people only talk about if they beat the Warriors to a very clear top three team in the entire league.
Right.
So you've got to keep going. Suddenly, that Chris Paul contract, maybe somebody's going to get you an offer to get off it, maybe even the Lakers.
No, you don't.
You deal with the fact that you're probably not going to contend 2 years from now. You're probably going to pay $50 million to do so. But right now, you have a real chance to win a championship. So you run it back, and you make another year of trying to find more 3-and-D players to fit next to your three core players.
And this gives you the opportunity to run it back with no real repercussions, right? Because instead of having to, you know, give up future picks and whatever you have to do to get off the Chris Paul deal, if anyone would even bite on it, you look at Chris Paul and you're like, Chris Paul is still an excellent player, and all of a sudden, having a Chris Paul, James
Chris
Harden backcourt
that he couldn't defend Klay Thompson,
right?
And that's not a problem anymore. There is no more 6'6" to 6'8" shooting guards in this league that are shooting 40.
Well, and of course, there's the when does Thompson come back, and where are the Warriors at that point discussion, which maybe we'll have in a different podcast, but. You know, the Rockets right now, if you were power ranking teams based solely off their position right now, I think it's probably Rockets 1, Nuggets 2, and then
Lakers 3 probably
Lakers 3, and then everyone else kind of in the jumble.
Right, and none of those teams, though, are in a situation where you go into a playoff series and you think, I can't beat them, as we had with the Warriors and anybody up to the Blazers.
It's a complete mess. For now, all of a sudden, any of those top teams could really beat anybody, and it wouldn't be shocking to see a 2-7 upset or a 3-6 upset or even a 1-8 upset if there's some of the cards fall out in the right way. I'm of the opinion right now, and for it doesn't seem like the Rockets are. It seems like they're still actively trying to trade Capella and Paul. But if I were them, I would stay put for at least one more year and see where you're at. And if you're not at a point you're going to win, then you probably move on it. But instead of giving up assets to get rid of Paul when he's still, you know, a functional, you know, all-star type player, I don't know why you wouldn't try to run it back with all the uncertainty in the West.
I agree. I think the other really interesting one that nobody's really talking about right now is the team on the other side of this trade who could very well be a 25-win team next year or could be a 55-win team next year.
That's right. Well,
they have the assets to make not a trade like the Anthony Davis trade, but they have the assets to make these things for Bradley multi-layer and not presenting their assets whatsoever. And if they do that, and Zion Williamson's what we think he is, and we're talking about maybe game 30, they swing for Beal, and Drew Holiday's playing at this level, Brandon Ingram's playing at the level we played at the end of this year, that could easily be a 50-win team.
So what's really, first of all, I want to start by saying good for the Pelicans, but also it's really, really sad that this is the Pelicans and not, you know, a team that has a fan base. You know, I think they did such a good job with this trade. I love how they have this really cool team that looks set to go when Zion comes and whatever else they have. And now they have, we'll see how Lonzo can play, how Ingram's healthy, blah, 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 blah. They have this war chest of picks for 10 years. But they still have no fan support, and there's the owners are still, you know, they've been doing the right things.
The owners want this team.
Right. The management, now that they have, you know, David Griffin and Swin Cash and all those, it seems like they're really getting their shit together on that front. But it's just too bad it's the Pelicans. But anyways, moving past
right,
that.
Alvin Gentry, by the way, really good coach. Very underrated with Davis over the last years. Alvin Gentry made three completely unique teams work with Anthony Davis and then made one completely unique team work without him. Between the Cousins injury, between Davis essentially deciding he didn't want to play anymore, between having to acquire and then drop Nikola Mirotic to different points.
Well, and so you got to think now, Griffin and Gentry probably have, you know, at least 4 to 5 years to figure this out with complete job security. There's the question marks over Ingram. Obviously, they seem to think he's going to be healthy, or they wouldn't probably have had him be the centerpiece of the trade. I'm still not super high on Lonzo, but Alonzo Drew Holiday backcourt is really, really fun. I like that a lot. Defensively, they're going to be incredible with those two in the backcourt combined with Zion and whoever they're able to pick up and then draft / these later picks. It's going to be fun. But if they don't draft well, then they're going to be in trouble, which is the really interesting part of this, is that it's really going to be the onus now on them, because really their assets are all draft picks at this point.
Entirely. I mean, but we talked about the Celtics for so long as having that war chest, and what they do with it. They signed, they didn't trade for DeMarcus Cousins. They didn't trade for Anthony Davis. They didn't trade for Kawhi Leonard. They didn't trade for Jimmy Butler. And they signed who in this time? Gordon Hayward and Al Horford were great players, but are not the sort of players that are worth not acquiring Anthony Davis or Kawhi Leonard for.
Right.
So are the Pelicans going to blow this? Are the Pelicans going to make the one swing trade for Kyrie Irving and then decide they don't want him anymore and alienate him? Or are they going to be in a situation in 5 years where Zion Williamson wants to get traded and then they trade him and they have 90 picks?
Well, it seems like, so what they did with Davis, right, is they spent stupid money on half-decent, youngish but with somewhat like 3 to 4 years of experience players like Solomon Hill, right? That was what they did. They wanted to keep their team young but also have a little bit of an element of leadership on the team. What they're doing with Zion, and who knows how good he's going to be, but is they're surrounding him with players that are within 2 to 3 years of his age, and it doesn't seem like they're going to get off that train. Now the interesting situation is, obviously, like you said, what if halfway through the season they're at 23 wins 24 wins, and the West is a mess and no one knows who's going to win, and they have this incredible amount of assets now? Do they do something like, exactly like a Bradley Beal trade, or a, you know, something like Gordon Hayward or something like that, you know, where it could push them into the upper tier of the Western Conference if Zion's on the upper level of how good people think he's going to be, and if Lonzo and Ingram are both playing well, all of a sudden that is a very good team. There's just such a high variability variance with how good this team could be, which is fun.
I heard a really interesting trade concept, just as an idea, a framework to build around. I don't think the version that I heard would actually get done on the Bulls part, but what if instead of before the season, they decide they're going to take number 4 and they're going to take Lonzo Ball and they're going to package them to the Bulls to take Lauri Markkanen? You talk about that fit. Essentially, he's a perfect fit next to Zion Williamson, both defensively, offensively, and next to Drew Holiday and Brandon Ingram. That, as a core 4 players for the roster, would be incredible. And if that's not enough, here's the thing: they have 4 Lakers picks they can throw in now on that trade.
Yeah, I don't like it for Chicago. I wouldn't touch that trade if I was Chicago, but I would absolutely do that if I was the Pelicans.
Right, you definitely need to put some sweeteners in there.
Yeah,
but if you talk about everything Mirotic did with Davis, you talk about Markkanen and Zion, you're talking about an even better version of that, basically perfect fit.
Right. It's going to be fun, and it's the Western Conference this year is just going to be absolutely bizarre, because it is really too bad that Thompson tore his ACL. That was a horrible moment, and I was rooting for the Warriors at that time, and he was having one of the great performances, and it was too bad. But goodness, for like the next year, that's going to be, it's going to open up some real interesting, I mean, for the first time since what, 2013-ish, that we don't really know who's going to be occupying any of the eight spots, between Houston, Portland, Denver, Dallas, Sacramento, San Antonio, Utah, Lakers, Clippers. I don't even know who I'm missing at this point, but
Grizzlies, potentially with John Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr.
I don't see that. I don't think they're there yet, but within the next year or two.
It's one of those things where they could be in it just as easily. I mean, realistically, the Suns could sign D'Angelo Russell and be in it.
Yeah, there's a ton of teams that could be there for sure. And
but it's suddenly open in a way that the West hasn't been in 8 years, about.
Right.
Maybe 9 years.
Right. I mean, we don't know, like we talked about, we don't know what Kawhi's doing. I don't know why he'd leave Toronto, but we don't have any idea what he's thinking, so he very well may.
9 years, by the way. Mavericks in 2011 was the last time the West was truly open, right, to more than two or three teams.
So, yeah, it's an interesting time here. I wanted to talk about a few of the other teams, Nuggets now, because they're now all of a sudden probably the deepest and most talented roster in the West. Is there any move that they could make that would put them up into a level where we'd be like, okay, they're finals contenders, or are they there already? Or
first thing I'd do if I were them is I would try to negotiate a more reasonable deal, but ensure that I maintain their basically every single player they have right now, because they have a few expiring contracts. But more than anything else, Paul Millsap. Millsap is old and could probably get a 2-year back somewhere else. But if he could sign for something in the range of $15 million a year for 4 years and ensure longevity with the Nuggets, that would be something they need for a team that's basically, their problem is that they're a good defensive team, and yet their two best players are truly atrocious defenders. So they really need somebody like Millsap that can defend multiple positions. And the other thing that's really their hope is, what happens if Michael Porter Jr.'s rookie of the year next year? We're talking about a guy that was the number one prospect in high school. He's a 6'10" small forward, power forward, who shoots threes at a very high rate, and has never played healthy basketball at a level above high school.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, right, is that if you're the Pelicans and you had gotten an offer that was Jamal Murray, Michael Porter Jr., three first-rounders, and maybe one of their bench players, would that not have been a better deal? And if you're the Nuggets, why would you not have done that?
I think for me it's because Anthony Davis and Nikola Jokic, you could certainly make them work together. Any combination of two dynamic bigs where one of them can shoot is going to work. But it's not a natural fit. It's not an obvious fit. It's almost like it's a challenge to build that team. And it's certainly not a challenge to build a team around just Nikola Jokic with the other good players they have. We could talk about them as a team that potentially could swing for one of these players like a Jimmy Butler. They'd have to do some restructuring, but one of these players like a Jimmy Butler or Kemba Walker, who's one of these second to third tier free agents. I mean, even if you want to talk about an interesting mixture of two bigs, what about Nikola Jokic next to Nikola Mirotic? What does that look like?
Bad on defense.
Oh, yeah, no shit.
I mean, that's the thing with the Nuggets is that if you look at their team right now, they don't really have any holes. They're very complete, and Paul Millsap is obviously awesome. And they have so much depth, and that's the problem, because they're not going to be able to re-sign these guys like Malik Beasley and Torrey Craig and Millsap and all these guys within 2 years. So their window is actually pretty small to make this team work. For me, if I'm looking at them and they didn't take it, I don't know if they did or didn't, but if they didn't take at least a swing at Davis, that makes no sense to me, because they're very Toronto-esque in that they're in a very good situation, but they probably needed a little bit extra to get over the top, and that probably could have done it for them.
Yeah, I think them and Philadelphia are kind of disparate souls in the same sense that they will obviously be 40-plus win team for the next 20 years if they keep their best player. But outside of their best young players, they have no way of maintaining everything else they have. It's all going to fall very soon. So your grander championship window of being the team that's this core is very big. But your actual legitimate championship window of winning with the players you have now is 2 to 3 years. So you're right. they would have to make a big swing like the Davis deal, but I don't think the Davis deal is the swing to make. I think the swing to make is going to be something a little bit more like, I don't know, maybe 2 years from now or a year from now, the Thunder decide that they don't want to do this with this core anymore and they put Paul George up for offer. Maybe we're talking about a situation where Kevin Durant comes back. He comes back with the Warriors. He signed for 3 years, but the Warriors realize they're no longer contenders. And what are they going to do? Maybe you could swing for somebody like even Jason Tatum once the Celtics realize that all the rest of their plans are not working out and Jason Tatum still got very high value.
I think you're right, probably. I like the Davis fit next to Jokic better. I think it's a good timeline if they could have convinced him to stay. And I think if they make that trade, whereas the Lakers had to, you know, mortgage their entire future, if you're the Nuggets, that wouldn't have been the case, right? You would have just had to give up, you know, a good young player in a Jamal Murray, plus a couple of young but good, you know, role players and a bunch of picks, and they would, you know, that would have put them, I in my mind, that would have made them instant favorites in the West. And, you know, it's hard to look at the Kawhi trade and not think that if you're a good team and you're not probably quite good enough, and I don't think the Nuggets are good enough in this iteration of them, that that's a trade that, you know, they shouldn't have made. But we'll never know.
On one hand, I agree, but on the other, the thing about Kawhi Leonard is that every single team on earth could use Kawhi Leonard and find a way to use him. Whereas in Anthony Davis, you have to do some mild structuring to make sure he works next to your big. And in particular, when we're talking about these same sorts of trades for point guards, I think it's been particularly dangerous because really the way the league works now, you need to be entirely structured around your primary ball handler. And if you're a team like, say, the Rockets, you could add Chris Paul. Chris Paul has to become secondary ball handler. And a lot of these guys, in particular, Kyrie Irving sticks out to me. Kyrie Irving had no interest whatsoever in becoming a secondary ball handler. That's why he was leaving Cleveland, because he wanted to be ball dominant. Yeah. So I don't know if it's necessarily true for every player the way it is true for Kawhi Leonard, but certainly Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, those types of players, Kevin Durant, once he comes back, those are the types of players you make that swing on no matter what.
Right. Well, and if we're the Thunder, I think if you're the Thunder, you have to see that you're not good enough right now, and there's no way to be good enough. If I were them, I'm looking to trade Paul George right now. And Steven Adams right now.
I fundamentally disagree that they're not good enough, because I think that's a team that, with the way the West is playing right now, they could win about half of those matchups, and if they get the right order, they could very easily go to the finals.
My thing is, I just don't think Russell Westbrook's winning a playoff series right now. After watching him in that Blazers series, even with Paul George, I just don't think that team's winning a playoff series or more
than. We haven't talked about Westbrook basically had the worst year of his career last year, and he's not going to have the worst year of his career next year necessarily. He still has every inch of his athleticism, and obviously he hasn't won a playoff series since Kevin Durant left, but he has been the most ball dominant player in a playoff series win multiple times. He's been the most ball dominant player in a Western Conference Finals win. He's been the most ball dominant player in a 3-1 loss in the Western Conference Finals that happened because of Durant. He is not like a guy that can't win playoff series.
No, I agree with that. I just don't think that they don't have any. It's kind of like the Blazers, except I think they're even worse situation than the Blazers. They don't have any moves to make. They can't get off the Steven Adams contract. They have all these kind of non-shooting good defensive players. I think they're fine. I think you're right. I think they don't. They probably should stay put for this year, but. I don't know if I don't think they're as good as the Blazers. I don't think they're as good as the Lakers. I don't think they're as good as the Nuggets, Rockets, or Jazz at this point. That's just my problem with them. After watching them in that playoff series, I just don't see any way for them to get better. That's my problem.
Well, one thing they could do is their best player could be healthy, which Paul George wasn't in that series. The other thing they could do is, I think the really only real option they have, if they're not actually going to consider moving George, is what are they going to do about Steven Adams, whose value is basically neutral right now? That the contract is too big for the type of player he is, but it's something that's worthwhile for the type of player he can be. You know who else matches that description is Clint Capela. And basically, the Thunder need a much more powerful, potent offensive center. And the Rockets, their defense has a lot of potential, but Capela was not particularly effective on defense this past season compared to his previous years. What if they just swap those two straight up? Would that not benefit both teams?
I don't think that helps the Rockets at all. I don't think Adams really fits in very well with the Rockets. I think that would be a good trade for the Thunder. I don't know. I'm the Thunder. the fun thing about this year, like you said, is that anyone can be anybody. So yes, you're probably right that they shouldn't do anything this year. I just don't see a way that even with a healthy Paul George, that team is going to be able to get good enough to be any of the top five teams in the West.
Right. I think they were there as recently as 40 games into this season, though. That's my only question is that still in them? And I think it is, and I don't think most people think it is.
I just don't think it's a playoff team. I think one of the biggest things that we saw this year is that there's a massive difference between playoff teams and regular season teams. And I think they're a much better regular season team because they're an excellent defensive team, but they have little to no scoring on that team. And they don't really have a way to acquire more.
Have essentially two guys who can score in isolation, and in this playoffs, one of them was playing hurt, and the other one has basically been off as an isolation player for two straight years now in Westbrook. And if you don't have those things, and you don't really have shooters there at all, which is a consistent problem with the Thunder going back a very long time, then you've got some issues. You know what they really needed to do is they needed to find a way to get Otto Porter Jr.
Yes.
If they could have traded Adams for Porter, which I think is a trade that the Wizards absolutely would have taken at the time, maybe this is a different situation.
Or even attach some picks onto it. But yeah, I think we've spent too much time talking about the Thunder. Is there anything else regarding this trade or anything else before we get into our mock draft?
I think a lot of people think this is the moment for these teams to start swinging for the fences and going for titles. I actually kind of disagree for most of these teams. If you're not in a two-year straight window, I think this is the point where you say, if I have a team that's good enough to get to 45 wins, maybe that wins the West now, and you stay put.
I think
in particular, the Blazers are a team that should be staying put right now.
Yeah, and they will. And it's interesting because they got to the Western Conference Finals, I think they were going to stay put anyways. But it would have been interesting, say, if they had lost them the second or the first round or even the second round this year. And people would have been, trade CJ, blah, 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 blah. And obviously Nurkic is out until February. But if that had changed kind of the discussion around it. But yes, all of a sudden you have all these teams that maybe were on the verge of blowing it up that all of a sudden now see themselves or should see themselves as contenders in the West. And obviously, if Kawhi leaves, all of a sudden you do not have a team that has no flaws.
You certainly don't.
Yeah, the Bucks, we saw Giannis is going to need to get a jump shot. It's just going to have to happen.
Right, we saw this obviously with Ben Simmons too. It's just, as great a player as they are in the league today, you cannot be the main ball dominant player on a team and not also be a shooter.
Kawhi did that. Kawhi wasn't a horrible shooter maybe, but he was never a shooter until he got into the league, and then all of a sudden he started working on a jump shot.
You went from a guy that could shoot the three if he was open to a guy who was a shooter to a guy that's now an elite shooter.
But
Kawhi also got a very different sort of...
Yeah.
I don't want to say work ethic, because I think work ethic is kind of an inevitable thing that people try to put on to other attributes they like. But Kawhi's got this sort of dedication about him where he can focus on just one thing in his game and rebuild that without changing any of the rest of his game that I don't think many other players do.
You think Giannis might be able to do something like that.
Sort of player that has a similar mindset, but last season watching him, it's very clear he had to make some sacrifices to other parts of his game to focus on speed, and he actually came in a little bit stronger and had to take that weight off over the course of the year to change the way the Kings were playing. And he grew in a lot of ways, but it came with drawbacks, and I think that's how most players are. I think if Giannis focused on shooting, he would have to sacrifice a lot of what he does potentially as a pick-and-roll big man on both sides of the ball, but as a role man and a creator. I think he'd have to sacrifice a lot from what he does in transition. It's just... he would have to change the way he thinks about playing the game to play as a guy with the jump shot. And I don't know if he's ready to do that yet.
All right. Well, let's wrap this portion of the podcast up and we'll move on to the mock draft in just a second. Welcome back to West Coast Bias. We're going to be doing our mock draft for the NBA draft that will be held Thursday evening. The way we'll be doing this is just alternating back and forth. Pick by pick, then we're gonna end the round with some just through the lottery. But then we're gonna end the round with some players that we think maybe should be going higher, or some specific players that we think are going to be good NBA players, and then maybe some picks we'd like to see if the Kings were to buy into the draft, and for the Blazers pick at 25. So Hunter, we'll start at number one with, I guess, the obvious one. Let's start there.
Okay, so the number one pick in this draft, I am obviously taking the clear best player in this draft. He's from Duke. He was a very high-rated prospect going into this year. Everybody was very impressed by him. I'm taking Cameron Reddish, though. Zion Williamson, obviously, he is the best prospect that's come to the league since Anthony Davis. Arguable with some people who would be very, very, very up on Luka Doncic. But unfortunately, two NBA teams were not that up on Luka Doncic. So I would say he is easily the best prospect to come since Anthony Davis.
I would be one of those people. I will be one of those people. I've been putting my eggs on the basket in this basket for a year now, so I can't really back off now. I'd rather have Luka Doncic. As of right now, I'd rather have Luka Doncic.
I would rather have Luka Doncic than literally any one player given their current contract situations entirely.
Yeah.
But Zion would probably be second. And then after that, you're talking about maybe going actually talking about veterans. And by veterans, I mean, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Nikola Jokic, and then is when you start a conversation.
Right. Well, okay. number two.
He's tall, but not that tall. He jumps really high. He's shaped like an offensive lineman. He blocks shots that are three pointers in the stands. He's cool and good and fun, and I like him.
Yeah,
and
he seems like a, at least if he didn't have the personality he had, I would be very, very much lower on him than I am. But he seems like a legitimately super hardworking guy and very nice guy as well.
There's a reason he's been a star since he was 15.
Right, and also he's poster child for why go to college, which I think a lot of people are loving about him as well, because he was probably not a top five pick if he didn't go to college, or at least not a top two pick. So that's interesting. Number two, it's for all, it would be shocking if Memphis did not go with Morant. So we're going to go with Ja. Thoughts on him as an NBA prospect?
My first thought is that it doesn't appear that Ja Morant is in the real GM system, which is objectively hilarious.
I know. No, I found him. He's just not on the top 10, which for some reason. But yes, he's there. I found him.
So Ja Morant is...
It's that mid-major disrespect.
If you like De'Aaron Fox, you're going to like Ja Morant a lot more because he can actually shoot the basketball. He is a wire-thin, incredibly fast, incredibly athletic point guard that plays like Russell Westbrook if Russell Westbrook lost 40 pounds of muscle mass and shot the ball at a much higher rate. Ja Morant is a non-shooter that is still the legitimate best shooting prospect to come in the draft as a listed point guard since, obviously, Luka Doncic is not listed as a point guard in 4 years, which is objectively hilarious given how bad
it is hilarious. And I find that, so if you read, you know, experts, which obviously know a lot more than I do, but people are very concerned with his release point and how low it is, and they still don't really think of him as a very good shooter, which is just bizarre, because I think if you watched him, he's certainly not an elite shooter, but he's definitely not Russell Westbrook. He's probably not even De'Aaron Fox.
He's a better shooter than both of them. He's a better shooter than Dennis Smith Jr. He's a better shooter than Colin Sexton. He's a better shooter than the guy that was supposed to be all those guys that didn't work out, who went to Duke last year, Trevon Duval. He is maybe not the best of this player archetype that's come into the league, but he's the best prospect of this player archetype that's come into the league since Russell Westbrook.
Right. I agree. I think it's a good pick by Memphis, especially considering the other options. Moving on to number three.
I am picking for the New York Knicks, who have some issues, namely among them that they have spent the entire year assuming that they're going to get a guy who is both half-torn Achilles and probably would have chosen the Nets over him if he actually had the choice. Their other big issue is that they spent the entire year assuming that they would get Zion Williamson, and turns out the draft lottery isn't actually rigged. So now they have a roster consisting of one incredibly great shot blocker, Mitchell Robinson, from the second round last year, and a whole bunch of failed prospects. Considering the amount of failed prospects they have, they need to get the most talented player on the board. The most talented player on the board is RJ Barrett.
Right.
He is the guy that I would have taken over Zion Williamson coming into this year. Unfortunately for him, I've now seen him play basketball. It's more than just highlights, and he seems to have a very bad case of the Andrew Wiggins.
So
the good news for him is that he's a much better Andrew Wiggins than Andrew Wiggins ever was.
So is there a chance that we're looking at RJ Barrett in a year like we did Jason Tatum at the end of last year?
Yes, I think that's the two stories. Is either you would basically, if Andrew Wiggins was here at 19, you would still draft Andrew Wiggins in this pick, because there's still the chance that that works out as a player archetype, that he learns his lesson, he becomes a great player, but there's also the chance he becomes Wiggins. So I think he is much more Jason Tatum than Andrew Wiggins, but that's really the risk you're running here. Is are right. you drafting another Rudy Gay, Carmelo Anthony type in a year where Rudy Gay and Carmelo Anthony are both either completely changed the way they played the game or out of the league entirely because of the way they played the game? Or are you drafting somebody who can learn to use his propensity to score on his own in a way that actually can be advantageous to a winning team? I think it will be the latter in the same way as Jason Tatum, and I would have to make this pick. Right. Particularly because once we get past this, there are no longer any players that I see as an all-star in the next 3 years.
So this fourth pick now, this is where it starts getting interesting, right? Because as we just went over, I'm glad we didn't do this mock in, 3 days ago, because like we were going to, because that would have been very different situation. The fourth pick is now obviously owned by the New Orleans Pelicans as part of that Davis trade. Do we want to make the assumption that this is not going to be traded for the purposes of this draft?
For the purposes of this draft, yes, okay. We have to assume, even if we're saying that this is somebody that's going to be traded further on down the line, at the moment, this is a pick that is not going to be traded.
Okay, well, I'm going to go with, for this pick then, I'm going to go with, I'm going to stick with Darius Garland for number 4, because I think if you're at this point and you're the Pelicans and you have all these picks, you need to be drafting on talent. And also, it's not entirely clear if Lonzo Ball is going to want to stay. As an aside, there's been not necessarily any indications that say he's going to leave or ask to be traded, but you can't rule it out. And it seems like Darius Garland is a guy who could come into the league. I instead of going into this completely blind, I actually did make a concerted effort to watch a couple of his games, and he is actually a really – Kyrie Irving is not a bad comparison for that guy. He can really shoot, very quick, I think he's easily the most talented player left in this draft, and I think if you're the Pelicans, I'm not sure if you keep the pick if someone like DeAndre Hunter or Jarrett Culver is really worth a fourth pick in this draft. So that's why I'm going with Garland.
So for me, this is what it comes down to. We have to remember, we're talking about these archetypes, that Morant is actually an elite prospect of his archetype. Garland is a middling prospect of his archetype, and the guy we're going to get to later, Coby White, is quite frankly a middling to below middling prospect of his archetype. So we aren't saying that Darius Garland is going to come into this league and beat Kyrie Irving. Right. I think the best example for him on draft night is where Jamal Murray was on draft night, as a guy who's a Kyrie Irving type player with a much lower ceiling. But I think that alone is enough to justify drafting him to a team that doesn't badly need a nice isolation scorer who can maybe become the second focal point of an offense, but could really utilize it in a lot of the same ways that Jokic works with Murray, I think, is the ways he could work with Zion. And Lonzo is somebody who has a very questionable fit next to Drew Holiday, and I think a much, much more natural fit when we're talking here.
Well,
and so I would agree with this pick. Has to be Darius Garland.
Right, and the way I look at it is if Darius Garland is Kyrie Irving light, I really like that next to Drew Holiday. And Lonzo Drew Holiday is very intriguing, but not necessarily doesn't make a lot of sense in a lot of ways. I think if it works, it's going to be really, really fun. I love to see it. But if it doesn't, it's going to be kind of a shit show. So it'll be interesting. So that's why I'm going with Garland here. Mainly it's because I'm so underwhelmed with the rest of the top prospects in this. And if New Orleans holds on to it, I think they should go talent.
Yeah, I agree. Although I will say, for as questionable as the offensive fit of Lonzo Ball and Drew Holiday is, it would be exceptionally fun to watch those two as a defensive backcourt in the NBA.
Right. And we'll see it, so.
So, picking fifth is the Cleveland Cavaliers. I will say I am probably much, much, much higher given my experience watching De'Aaron Fox in his very bad rookie year with great flashes of highlights and very good second year. I am probably much higher on Colin Sexton than most. Colin Sexton probably ended the year better than he thought given how he started it, but the simple truth is that Colin Sexton was a bad NBA player for the first 60 games of his career and barely got above a bad NBA player once he improved.
Right.
So if Darius Garland was available, I would draft him here, no questions asked. But he is not, and I really don't think that White, who is the only other real guard prospect we're going to be talking about in this draft, is anything like worthwhile here. So I am going to forego the two best players left in this draft, which I think are very firmly Jarrett Culver and DeAndre Hunter, and I'm going to take the big swing of the fences and take Cameron Reddish. I think Reddish is a much higher upside than those players and a much, 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 much lower floor. But when you're talking about the Cleveland Cavaliers, The only player they have is Kevin Love. They need to take some shots. He is the only shot at a star left in this lottery that's expected to be drafted here. And the only other shot left at a star in this draft entirely is a guy that's as low as 23rd in Bol Bol.
That's pretty much exactly my reasoning, and I also had Cam Reddish going here. I'm not sure if he actually will, but if you're Cleveland, you need talent. You need a potential guy. I think people... Obviously, Cam Reddish was just incredibly underwhelming at Duke. But I think it's almost... The pendulum has almost swung too far to the other side. I think we've seen this with Barrett to an extent. I think we saw it with Tatum. To where, you know, people are maybe underrating him a little bit now. And I think we saw it with
Bagley, too.
Bagley, that's a great example.
3 years before, we really saw the opposite happen, which I thought was very funny. With Jahlil Okafor, where the hype went up when he had an underwhelming season at Duke, but it's because he won a championship because of the better players on it.
The common denominator is high expectations for freshmen going to Duke. But anyway, so we're going with, let me make sure I have this listed, Cam Reddish to the Cavs. At the sixth pick for the Suns, I think there's a real chance they trade this pick if they're able to sign a D'Angelo Russell or something like that. Obviously, this is, you know, there's a lot of, this is one of the most things, interesting things about this NBA offseason is that there's so many different dominoes that could fall into place. If Kyrie goes to Brooklyn, you'd think that D'Angelo Russell would, you know, probably go to a team like Phoenix or Indiana or Utah. But on the basis of this, they need a point guard. Coby White is the only point guard available. I'm a little higher on Coby White than a lot of people seem to be. He's another one of these point guards that seems like they have a very low release on their shot, and people are worried about that. But he's also a very good shooter. I think he's a little smarter player. I watched him a lot than people, teams tend to give him credit for. Very Jamal Murray-like, certainly. I think he's a little more consistent than Jamal Murray was, though, in college and will be in the NBA. I think he's a little more Damian Lillard, De'Aaron Fox hybrid than actually he is Jamal Murray, and it just, there's no other pick that really works for the Suns is really the most important thing here, so I'm going Coby White out of North Carolina.
The incredibly stupid thing about the Suns is that they have really good prospects at every single position except for point guard, and they're a terrible team. None of those players are good NBA players, despite the fact that they all look like they're going to be great NBA players, and some of those guys are well past the point in their career where they should stop being looking like NBA players and start playing like them. Devin Booker, obviously, most of all, he had a 70-point game 2 full years ago, and it's still not clear that he helps a team win NBA games, which is embarrassing. He's a guy who's won the three-point contest once and finished second in once, and he is a 37%, I believe, career three-point shooter. He is just...
Yeah.
He is not as good as he should be, and he's atrocious on defense, and he really needs to be playing next to a true point guard, and I'm a little bit worried about the development of this team, especially between him and Ayton, both good players who haven't contributed anything. But realistically, you can't draft over Ayton. You can't draft over Booker. You probably can draft over Mikal Bridges, but he's the only guy I'm sure is going to be good, so I wouldn't. And they have so many wings behind Bridges that it's really questionable just to bring in another middling wing like DeAndre Hunter, whose ceiling and floor are both essentially Mikal Bridges. So you have to take a point guard, and it has to be Coby White, because he's the only actual starting point guard prospect left in this draft.
As far as we know, but yes.
It's entirely possible that Kyle Guy becomes the best point guard in the draft.
Or the other, Ty Jerome, for that matter. Okay, the Bulls pick, very interesting pick, now that both these point guards are off the board. Who are we taking?
So, Bulls pick, if I'm the Bulls, the thing I'd be doing right now is I would be trying to package Chris Dunn and Zach LaVine to a team that somehow values Zach LaVine despite that contract, because Chris Dunn's still a good prospect, but he's definitely not going to work out with the Bulls. He needs to be in a very good development organization like the Spurs. I think in the Spurs he could work out. And Zach LaVine is not a player that helps you win NBA games. He is very, very, very much like the other 20-plus point-per-game scorer that hasn't really won anything that we just talked about, Devin Booker, despite a very different play style. I don't want him on my team anymore, and he has some value, so he's got to go. So I am drafting, assuming that they need somebody in that backcourt, and I am going to take Jarrett Culver, because between Culver and Hunter, the two most talented players left in this draft, I think Culver is the one who is much more likely to be useful as a primary offensive weapon and secondary ball handler, whereas Hunter seems much more an off-ball player.
So I'm interested in what your thoughts on Culver are, because I was going into the tournament, I had watched a few Texas Tech games and I was very high on him. I thought he was very good. He obviously is a great defender. He can do a lot more with the ball than maybe you'd think someone like him would be able to do. But I thought he was kind of underwhelming in the tournament despite Texas Tech's run to the final. and it's hard for
him. He wasn't a very big part of that run to finals.
Yeah, he really wasn't. I mean, he was, but not in a way where he was carrying the team like you'd think that he would have had to make Texas Tech go to the final.
Right, especially when you talk about the other players in this draft who we're going to be talking about who played well in the tournament, especially DeAndre Hunter. They were the guy on their team that needed to be, no matter what their play style was. Zion was, Ja Morant very, very much was. RJ Barrett wasn't, but only because Zion was. Kobe White was the only good part of UNC this year. And when you talk about Jarrett Culver, you're talking about a guy who's objectively the best player on the Texas Tech roster, but he had a lot of games where he could have been not on the team and it wouldn't change the result.
My thing with Jarrett Culver is that he's a great defender. And this is how I look whenever I'm comparing Culver and Hunter. This is how I look at it, is that they're both have a ceiling and floor that are just way too close to each other. Like both probably pretty high ceiling, low floor, or other way around, low floor, high ceiling type players. And I think Hunter has a little more room to become a player that you want. If I was the Blazers, for instance, Blazers need a three. I would rather have Hunter than Culver at this pick. He's a better shooter. He fits into a role player. I don't think you want Jarrett Culver to be a primary ball handler on an NBA roster, which he was for Texas Tech.
The difference is, I think, unlike Hunter, he can.
Right, this is true. I don't know. For me, I just like Hunter better as a prospect, but also as a fit for a team like Chicago, I can see why they would want someone who could handle the ball, especially because they don't really have a point guard who could handle the ball right now.
Also, you talked about with the best case scenario of what RJ Hunter is what the best player on their roster already is.
RJ Hunter, famed Georgia Southern superstar.
RJ Hunter, I think he projects out to very much be, very specifically actually DeAndre Hunter, I think he is going to be Otto Porter. And I don't think you need two Otto Porters on a team that has yet to have any other good players that aren't Lauri Markkanen.
He does seem to be kind of Otto Porter in a nutshell, but yes, you're right.
Which is why he's perfect for Portland, because Portland and Sacramento and New Orleans and every single other middling team in the West needs Otto Porter, and somehow he ended up on a truly atrocious team instead. Yes.
All right, so we are moving on to the first Atlanta Hawks pick. There's been rumors. Let's preface this by saying that there's been rumors. I don't quite understand why, but there's been significant rumors that they want to move up to number four to draft, presumably, Cam Reddish. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, other than the fact that they have six picks and they need to get off some of those picks somehow. These are not necessarily the picks I think I'd want to get off of, but... At this pick, I think Hunter is the obvious choice.
Yes.
I don't think there's really... This is where the draft, at least as far as the way we've been... It's been projected to us in terms of the prospects. This is kind of where it drops off, starting at the next pick. But I think Hunter is kind of the obvious choice here for them. And I think he actually works pretty well alongside that Hawks roster with Trae Young and John Collins and Kevin Herter, who all need touches themselves. I like DeAndre Hunter. I've always liked him since his last year in Georgia or at Virginia. I soured on him a little bit before the tournament, and then he started having some big games, so I got a little more back on the bandwagon. But regardless of how I feel about him, I think he's kind of the obvious pick at this point.
Right. So I have. I think just because of the way our mock draft developed, where we are assuming that New Orleans is picking at five, which at four, which greatly changes the way this draft is going to happen, rather than if somebody trades up to four for either Reddish or for the Darius Garland, right? But the way this mock draft develops, the second best fit for them in this entire lottery is very obviously DeAndre Hunter, who fits a team that's kind of on the trajectory where they need good role players. So it's going to be that. But if they are going to trade up, which is a stupid thing to do, it really the only way you can justify that is if it's for Reddish or for Garland. Anybody else, any other player in this group, it's not worth it.
Well, and Garland makes no sense for that team, so it really has to be Reddish.
So it has to be Reddish. I don't think that's a worthwhile decision for them, because they're in a position right now where any one of Reddish, Hunter, or Culver could realistically fall for them, because the Bulls and the Suns both so badly need point guards that they have no real choices besides Garland and White if they're available. I'm gonna say Cam Reddish here, and I'm going to be very happy with that decision for them.
Uh, you are at nine.
Sorry, not Reddish, the other Hunter.
Hunter, yeah. This is pick for pick the way I had it in my mock, just so you know. The only variation is Hunter versus Culver for Chicago and Atlanta, but those are the only two. Moving on to the Wizards at number nine, this is where presumably, and this is fun. I think it's interesting because we don't know really why this is the case, but this is where experts seem to think it takes a drop. Who do we have for the Wizards?
We don't know who Seko Dumbuya is.
That's probably true. I have not watched one video. Yes, but somehow he's still kind of the consensus ninth pick in the draft.
Yeah, I gotta say about Seko Dumbuya is that he gives me very, very extreme Frankie Ntilikina vibes, where he's just been 10th on my mock drafts since September, and I don't know who he is or why.
Yep.
And then I watch his highlights, and I still don't know who he is or why. And I read about him, and I don't know who he is or why. I don't understand this pick. I do not understand why you're going to take another exceptionally long French player that doesn't play minutes in the French league. We're talking about a guy who, his per 36, not even his actual record, his per 36 as a more power forward focused wing is 15 per game, 6 boards in a terrible European league, a bad European league. It's not a good league. And we're talking about picking him at 9th overall over somebody like Brandon Carter, Bol Bol. I am not going to take Seko Dumbuya with this pick. I am going to probably, he's a guy you're going to come back to win this lottery. I think he'll definitely go in this lottery. But I am going to take, I think, the only player left in this draft with a real chance of being a star, who's been projected as high as 8th and as low as 26th in different mock drafts that I've seen. And I'm going to take Bol Bol.
Oh, we're screwing up the order here. I like it. Bol Bol is an interesting guy because I watched him for his first few games at Oregon, and I think a lot of the kind of the discussion around him was kind of, you know, overstated. I think his injuries are certainly the issue. I don't think his other flaws are really the issue. The dude is a really good shooter. He can put the ball on the floor. There's some question about his like motor or something like that. He's in college. Like, no one really knows that stuff. Like, no one really can project that stuff in college, especially when he only plays an eighth of a season. If I was someone like the Wizards who need to take a swing, I would not be drafting Seko Dumbuya for sure. I would be drafting Bol Bol or maybe like a Nasir Little or Romeo Langford or someone like that who at least has some ability to make this team exciting again.
Right.
Also, the Wizards haven't had a competent center since I can remember.
Yeah, right. We're talking about Dwight Howard, their starting center right now. So why not? I think the consensus that I'm seeing is the Celtics have so many picks and have so much room to just worry about developing talent that Bol Bol usually ends up in a late lottery or early mid-round pick with them. But if you're the Wizards, none of these other guys bring anything to the table that you need. So I have no real interest in anybody but Bol Bol, and he'd be my pick here. The other thing about him that I think is fascinating is he was as high as 4th when he was actually playing on most major mock drafts, and it was only after he got injured that he started to fall. And obviously injury concerns are going to be a problem with anybody that's shaped like he is. He's very long, he's very athletic, and he is very frail. But Kevin Durant just had his first major injury at 30, and he has been considered the same injury.
I was just about to say that. His injury also didn't really have anything to do with his size. It was a foot injury. So
he's never had an injury that has anything to do with his size.
Yeah. So at
Brandon
10,
Ingram's never been hurt in a way that has anything to do with the size. His one major injury is a fairly terrifying heart issue. And same thing when you look at somebody like a what's that guy's name? Never mind. Don't worry about it.
All right, we'll think of it later. So at 10, we have the Hawks picking again. I think that this is kind of the consensus pick, but it actually kind of works for me. I don't know if he's going to be very good, but I think it makes sense alongside John Collins. The latest in the line of Texas centers that don't really do anything but are somehow lottery picks all the time.
They all run and jump. That's their only.
They all center. Do run and jump. This is Jackson Hayes from Texas. John Collins, not really a very good defender. This would be a very fun, athletic, kind of modern center. This guy seems a whole hell of a lot like a Jared Allen type. He would work very well in this lineup, and I just don't really know where else after we're picking. We've already picked a 3 in Hunter, 8, so I don't think Dumbuya really works very well. And so I think we're gonna go with Jackson Hayes, even though I don't love him as a prospect in general.
Right. He's one of those picks that you only make when you have the luxury of already having John Collins and Trae Young essentially having worked out. Maybe their ceiling's not that much higher than where they are right now, but they're already used to NBA players. And you also, this is the pick you make when you realize that John Collins and Trae Young, who are their only real guarantees to be in their starting lineup 3 years from now, are truly atrocious defenders. And at the very least, Jackson Hayes has a lot of useful attributes. So I am very comfortable with the pick of Jackson Hayes. I think there's a reason that he is there on just about every mock draft right now. I don't think he's particularly valuable to any of the Timberwolves, the Hornets, the Heat, the Celtics, or the Pistons. I don't think he's particularly valuable to the Wizards or the Bulls or the Suns. It's got to be one of these two Hornets. It's got to be one of these two Hawks picks, or he's going to be falling much further.
Right.
So now we're getting into something a little bit more interesting. When we get to 11, we are well out of the players that really have any reason to be going where they're going. At this point, I think the players that you're considering are aforementioned Sekou Doumbouya, who's got a lot of potential and almost no hope at all of actually doing anything with that potential. You're talking about somebody like PJ Washington, who is much better at Kentucky than he gets any credit for because it was not a good Kentucky team. Or you're talking about Brandon Clark. For me, the best of those three players is Brandon Clark. He does a lot of things very well, and he is also very large and very strong, and that's pretty much what I'm looking for at the 11th pick. I don't think he is the best player of the two power forwards from Gonzaga that are going to be drafted, but I think you can't justify Rui Hachimura at 11. You can definitely justify Clark.
I also had Brandon Clark going to the Wolves at 11. I think at this point it's just really from 11 to about 40. Could go anyway, which is really the redeeming factor of this draft, because it's just incredibly interesting that it's really going to come down to preference. And somebody like you said, Jared Allen, if he doesn't go at 10, he could not go till 25 or something like that, through no fault of his own, really. There's just teams are going to be looking for a specific type of player. You just don't really know what's going on. For my 12th pick is the Charlotte Hornets, and they're another one of these teams, much like the Wizards, who just need something. It seems like Kemba Walker is going to be staying, so they need some kind of talent alongside of him. So I'm going to go with Nasir Little, who going into college was a very high-rated prospect, but really didn't do a whole lot at all in college. But I think Charlotte needs to gamble, and I think this is about the range where he's projected to go anyways. So I'm going to go with Nasir Little at this pick.
Nasir Little is also my pick, projected top 5 pick before having a bad season. Him and Cameron Reddish, I think, are very similar cases on very different teams. Nasir Little actually was a little bit more effective near the end of the year, which is a plus he has over Reddish. And again, quite frankly, the Hornets need anything at any position except for point guard if they're assuming they're keeping Kemba. If they're not, they need anything at any position. That is a not good team with a lot of cap space tied up long term.
Yeah.
That brings us to 13, another not good team with a lot of cap space tied up long term. The poster child of not good teams with a lot of cap space tied up long term, the Miami Heat. Quick question. Who is the best player on the Miami Heat?
Probably Dragic.
Yeah, I guess. And yet they were unhappy he opted into his contract for $20 million. That's not good.
No. Josh Richardson, hopefully.
Josh Richardson is a guy that we've always said is about a starting caliber small forward in the NBA. He's getting paid $60 million a year. That seemed like a really good deal at the time. Not so much anymore. Their backup point guard is a starting power forward, essentially, in Justice Winslow. Love Justice Winslow. Not for that team. And obviously, they're paying $30 million a year to Hassan Whiteside because he blocked a lot of shots 5 years ago. Terrible, terrible deal. So they need anything. And this is finally where Sekou Doumbouya needs to go, because Sekou Doumbouya could become something, and they need someone who has any chance at all of becoming something.
I think it's a good point. I use the same logic. I had Romeo Langford going at this pick, in terms of just someone they need some sort of scoring out of him. So yes, the next pick was the Celtics, and as you alluded to earlier, I had Bol Bol going at this pick. And I don't really know what to do with it anymore, because I don't really see anything. I think they do need a big. There are not really any bigs that I'm interested in at this point. think PJ Washington's probably about the closest to that. He's not really a really big player in whole. I mean, I'm the Celtics. I might be trying to package this pick for something. But if not, I think I probably would go for PJ Washington. Hope he turns into somewhat of an Al Horford type player. If Brandon Clark or was available at this point, I might go for him. But yeah, I think at this point in the draft, if you're the Celtics and you're staying put, I think PJ Washington, who I agree with you, I think he was very underrated just because that Kentucky team was not quite as good as people thought they were going to be.
Yep.
So I'm going to go with PJ Washington at this pick.
If I were picking there, I think I would have taken either PJ Washington or Rui Hachimura, but it's hard to really justify Hachimura to the Celtics because their two best players, once Al Horford ages out of his relevancy and once Kyrie Irving leaves, are large wings. And Rui Hachimura only has any real potential in the league as a Kawhi Leonard type large defensive oriented wing. I think he's very similar to what Leonard was in college, but he has a much lower offensive ceiling. Great pick at 14, probably not to the Celtics.
Yeah.
So I'm going to agree with Washington there.
Yeah.
That's the lottery, which to reiterate, we have, I think, very confident in our top eight or so. And then once we get past that, it's more subjective. Zion Williamson to the Pelicans, obviously. Ja Morant to the Grizzlies, obviously. RJ Barrett to the Knicks, obviously. Darius Garland to the Pelicans at 4, potentially to be traded later, but if not, still a good pick for that team. Cameron Reddish to the Cavaliers at 5. Kobe White to the Suns at 6. Jarrett Culver to the Bulls at 7. DeAndre Hunter to the Hawks at 8. Bull Bull to the Wizards at 9. Jackson Hayes to the Hawks at 10. Brandon Clark to the Timberwolves at 11. Nassir Little to the Hornets at 12. Sekou Doumbouya to the Heat at 13. And finally, the Boston Celtics taking PJ Washington at 14.
Yeah.
So say you're picking 15th overall, and you are any draft, any team, and you have bought this pick for cash because this draft's really not worth that much. So tell me a player you want at 15 and what team you think would be the best for.
So I think this is the reason why, this is what I said earlier as well, this draft is just so incredibly interesting. And as a team, as a fan of a team that's picking at 25, which is pretty much right in the heart of this range, I watched a Lewis King video, who's the Oregon small forward, who is one of my favorite prospects in the late first, early second round. A reporter asked him to give a range for what his agent's given him as far as teams, and he said 15 to 40, which is just bizarre to me. So if I think at this point, the players that are really left at this point that are noticeable. You have Hachimura, you have Alexander Walker from Virginia Tech.
Nikhil Alexander Walker, because it does sound like that's a full name.
Yes, this is true. I mean, you have, goodness, there's so many other people. You have Nicholas Claxton from Georgia, who's been rising everyone's boards lately. You know, you have Kevin Porter Jr. from USC, who's a guard. You have
Bruno Fernando's a guy I really like.
Bruno Fernando. You have Okiki. You have Talon Horton Tucker from Ohio State. You have Thibault. You have Lewis King.
You have Jontay Porter, who's torn his ACL twice, but was an elite center last year and a better draft.
You have future Doug McDermott, Tyler Harrow from Kentucky. you have Cam Johnson from North Carolina, who I would be all over if I was the Thunder.
You have my two personal favorite players in this draft outside of the lottery, just because of the fact that they have cool names and are very strong. You have the Tennessee wings, and obviously the better one's going to be Admiral Schofield, even though he's lower in almost every mock draft because they have Admiral Schofield. But Grant Williams also. Those are guys who can play basically shooting guard to power forward.
The PJ Tuckers of the world.
Yeah, exactly. They are exactly PJ. They are both just PJ Tucker. Exactly.
Schofield's probably a little more skilled. They're both actually probably a little more skilled, Schofield especially, but yeah, in terms of the NBA. If you're asking for me to give, and this is where I think it really gets interesting to me, is, like I said, I think 15 to really 45-ish is just could go anyway. The three that I have are, like I said, Lewis King from Oregon, who I think actually has really, really high upside. I don't know if star upside is correct, but he was a five-star recruit in college. He's 6'8", built like Kevin Durant. Really sweet shooting stroke, needs to work on his dribbling and ball handling a little bit. Long, lanky defender, do a lot of things. If I was picking for the Blazers at 25, I would absolutely love to have him. Second is Kevin Gele from Florida State, who I watched, you know, all year at Florida State. Love him. He can do.
Who, by the way, is somehow equal in most mock drafts with Casey Okpala.
Yeah, ridiculous. I thought he was amazing at Florida State. He's an incredible shot blocker. Dikembe Mutombo's nephew, I believe.
Yes, and he is a very large 6'11". I think he could be 7'1", 7'2", by the way that players are measured. But he, at the combine, only measured like 6'10 and a half. But he's very large.
Very mobile, not a horrible shooter. Really could, incredibly smart defensive player too. He really kind of quarterbacks the defense in a way that not very many players can do. I'm not going to use Draymond Green's name in this instance, but if you watch Florida State, that's kind of how he played. Was he kind of just sat back and switched on to people and blocked a lot of shots, and those are my top two. I also like Thibault from Washington. I think he's a much better shooter than people give him credit for. So those would really be my top three. Really, my top two, though, are Kevin Gele and Lewis King from Oregon.
Yeah, I really like Kevin Gele, and I really like Bruno Fernando, who I think are kind of oxidants of what you want out of a kind of limited center. Kevin Gele's defensive upside is massive, and he is useful on offense, whereas Fernando is essentially offensively a guy we're talking about as a really, really effective pick-and-roll center offensively, but not so much defensively. He's a little bit more limited. I think a good comparison for him is Willie Cauley-Stein, who was not that prospect coming into the league, but in the league is that player. He's a guy who can get you probably 16 points per game as a very heavy use pick and roll center, but not really a viable defender whatsoever. Both of those guys, I would pick somewhere around 20 to 25, not so much around 15. But when we're talking about players in this part of the draft, I'm looking well past the prospects that are actually getting interest from people for the three that really interest me. One of them, by far the most interesting to me, is Taco Fall, because he is 7'7" and useful. He has a lot to learn for a guy who's already 24 years old, but he was a useful player at 7'7" in college, which is almost never happens. And he reminds me a lot of the only other person who's played in the league at 7'7", which is obviously a close money table, in that he almost doesn't fit on a basketball court. And I think a team can find a way to make that useful for a guy who doesn't have major injury issues despite that height historically, and for a guy who might actually have some pretty good skills besides just shot blocking and dunking without jumping. A good comparison for him is probably everybody's favorite role player that nobody believes is really a good player, Bogdan Marjanovic. I think he's a guy who's going to play 15 minutes a game, put up maybe 8 points a game, but get him hilariously easy 6 boards a game. And that's useful to a lot of teams. The other two guys are both bigs. Admiral Schofield, I already mentioned, who's probably more of a wing than a big, but in this league, PJ Tucker comparison, shooting guard to center. He's a guy I really like for Sacramento just because he provides something they don't have. But I think there's a player who fits a similar archetype in a much better way, and that is Arizona State, former San Diego State's Zion Cheatham. Zion Cheatham had played at different points in his career from small forward to center as a starter. He is a somewhat small 6'10". Realistically, he's probably about 6'8". But he is somewhere in between Draymond Green and Paul Millsap offensively as a player in his play style. The only difference is that unlike either of them, he's a true elite athlete. He's a guy with a 47-48-inch vertical. He's a guy who can block shots in a way that Draymond Green, despite his length, really can't. He's a guy who can run up and down the court with the team as fast as the Kings or the Bucks. And he's a guy that, although his jumper's broken, his jumper's easily comparable to Green's. His problems are age. He's 24, which is not ideal for a rookie. His size, and probably more than anything else, his lack of ability to create on his own for a guy who has so many skills. He's not really somebody who you can rely on if you have him as your starting center to actually produce this position. But that's a position that probably shares with Draymond Green, and that's not been a problem for the Warriors winning championships. And all of these things are things that I'm not really worried about a player that could go as low as 60 or as high as 25. I would easily take him at 15 if he was available, and he will be available.
Yeah.
Only other guy I want to talk about is Jalen Daniels from San Diego State, who was previously a lottery pick in projections last year and this year, and both times fell once people actually saw him play. He has an incredible face-up jumper from the mid-range, but he's not really a three-point shooter. all he's got going for him is that for a guy who's 192 pounds, 6'10", he is somehow an elite perimeter defender, which is very helpful, but he can't really play small forward, and he can't really play against NBA-sized bigs. I don't think he has any real use in the league.
Yeah. The only other two players that I wanted to, or two players I really wanted to give a shout-out to, Naz Reid from LSU, who for some reason was on the Real GM top 10. Maybe they know something. Really athletic, good ball handler, excellent shooter. Really good value for a second round pick as someone coming off the bench who can really knock down the three and play a little bit of defense. So him, and then also Terrence Mann from Florida State, who's projected to be from 45 to 60, who was one of my favorite players in college all year. Almost 6'7", good shooter, really, really, really smart player, like exceptionally smart defensive player. I would love him as a second round pick for anybody, and I would maybe even take him at the end of the first round. I think he's going to be really good.
Yeah, I think Florida State almost every year has a lot of guys that I'm really excited about who have the same sort of build, the same sort of length, and the same sort of skill set. And somehow only Jonathan Isaac of any of them has really drawn interest. And Isaac not really getting a lot of interest in the league just because he was picked so high and had such high expectations and is always in reality the guy who's going to be an elite role player. But he's already an elite role player. He does a lot of things on defense, and he is semi-useful on offense. He has a jumper. I think Terrence Mann's a very similar type of player. I don't think he's really a guy you want holding the ball that much, even though at 6'7", he can. But he's a guy who shoots at 40%. He's a guy who defends his position and above. I really like him. And obviously, as mentioned, also really like Florida State.
I think the difference between him and some of the other Florida State prospects is that I think a lot of the Florida State prospects have been built on their athleticism. And not that Terrence Mann isn't athletic, but his really – and this is one of the reasons why I think they did better this year than they have in the past few years. He's just such an intelligent player who's also extremely athletic. And he's got the length. He's almost 23, so that's a little bit of a downside. But if I'm – again, somebody like the Blazers who needs a contributor who's going to be smart and not make a lot of mistakes and play really good defense and maybe shoot a little bit of three, he's somebody who I'd love to see. And if the Blazers buy into the second round, I would love to see that happen.
I would, just for what it's worth, I am of the opinion that Florida State is one of the top 10 teams to just watch on ESPN on a Wednesday afternoon during the college basketball season.
Yeah.
Because even though I think both of the players we're talking about here are better than their average prospects, literally every player that gets recruited to that program is a hilariously interesting, incredibly long for his position player that does a bunch of things that he probably shouldn't be doing.
I've certainly watched more Florida State basketball than any other college basketball team in the last 2 to 3 years, which is hilarious. But
I think they're my favorite of literally all Power 5 programs these days.
Which is weird because I have no affiliation or interest in Florida State. It's in a horrible city, in a horrible place, in a horrible state.
Their football program. Historically.
They also have a very youthful-looking 70-year-old coach, so that's a plus.
That is bad. It's pretty impressive.
That will do it for this portion, for the mock. We will try to be live for the draft on Thursday if we are available. If not, we'll record afterwards and see what we got. But yes, that has been it for today.